This is an oral history interview conducted with the Ortners on December 11th, 2003 at the Kress Foundation. I'm Florence Daniels. This is an oral history interview with Mr. and Mrs. Ortner on December 11th, 2003 at the Kress Foundation in New York City. Correction, this interview is being conducted on December 29th, 2003.
Okay, ready to go?
Yes, I'd like to.
What day is today? December?
It's all on tape. I did it at home.
Oh, you did that already?
Yes, the
location. Tell me then. Today is the 29th. Today is December 29th, 2003, right?
Right.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
Let's roll.
Okay, would you define a brownstone for me, please?
Oh, dear. Well, a brownstone has come to be a generic name for row houses, city row houses. Because in New York City, most of them are brownstone, but then there are a lot of limestones, and some rich people have had row houses made of marble, and some of them are of brick. And then, of course, there are some old houses that were made of wood. And so in New York City, it's come to be the generic term for all city row houses. So people live in brownstones, really, live in wood houses, which have now been turned to have plastic facades. And the word is also caught on outside the United States. My wife and I went to a conference some years ago where they were talking, it was back to the city conference, and people in various cities were referring to their row houses as brownstones. So,
is there such a thing as brown stone?
Well, the stone, yes, there is. It is a stone that comes from the sea as sand filters down in the sea and forms stone and then dug up later on. It's made of particles of little thing of sea of silicone falling to silicone falling to the ground to the bottom of the sea and over the centuries and centuries hardening to become an actual stone. When it's quarried, it's actually a pinkish brown, but as it dries, it turns browner brown, and there are many shades. And most of the New York brownstone comes from Connecticut near the Connecticut River, where it was quarried and taken across the Sound to New York because it was very cheap to quarry it with steam machinery in these days at the beginning of the brownstone age, and close by, easy to ship across the water, it carved up along the shores of Brooklyn and Manhattan. Some of it came from New Jersey also, but most of Connecticut. It became a cheap stone, and because it also could be carved into various wonderful designs very cheaply also, all with steam machinery, which was the new thing in the 19th century. So brownstone became the stone of the middle classes. Stone had formerly been the province of the ultra-wealthy. Poor people had brick houses, or if they had less money, wood houses or shacks of one kind or another. But the rich had stone. Now the invention of steam machinery, which made carving and cutting and quarrying, cutting and carving very cheap, brownstone became available to middle-class people. And so we have brownstone houses, row houses.
What years are you speaking of, roughly?
Well, starting probably brownstone, it started much earlier, around 1845 or so, at the base of, I think, Trinity Church was in brownstone, and they also used it. And even earlier, I think, City Hall had a base of brownstone, the back of it facing north, which nobody was supposed to see. And it was used very little. But when it became obvious that it was carvable very cheaply, and it became the stone that people used when they were building multiple dwellings. So the man who bought up a 100-foot lot here, as he did on 79th or 80th Street here, he would buy up 100 feet. The land was sold at auction. He would buy up 100 feet, and he'd put in X number of brownstone houses, one on top of each other. It was a cheap way to build because they had common walls. It was easy to build, and the stuff was very appealing to people at the time. You could make attractive houses for very little money in those days.
You said one on top of each other. You mean a two or next three to each story? Other. Oh, next to each other.
Next to each other, yeah.
I see. If I, as a novice, was walking down the street, how could I tell what was a brownstone?
If you're looking at it, it's almost certainly brown, brownstone.
But is there any other distinguishing features, the door, the windows, or anything that...
Not particularly, I think, but of course, some of the brownstone was badly installed. If you installed it in the wrong direction, it could chip off easily, and you would see it. Sometimes a whole row would be showing the signs of wear and age.
I see. Now, let's talk a little about your own personal experiences. When did you buy your first brownstone or get interested in it?
Well, now, this is a long story. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
There's more to buying a brownstone than just buying a brownstone. You're dealing with the history of the city and of all the neighborhoods and what happens in those neighborhoods. Evelyn and I were married in 1953. We lived in Brooklyn Heights for 10 years in a wonderful old brownstone, a wide, magnificent brownstone, beautifully aged.
You owned it?
No, we didn't. We rented a floor in that.
Okay.
We rented a floor in that. And we lived there for about 10 years, at which time we wanted to buy a house, and that was in Brooklyn Heights. The 1960s when we started looking, and the houses there were very expensive for the time.
How much were they?
A house at that time in the Heights would have run for $40,000, $45,000 some of the time, maybe a little bit, so a little more depending on condition, which was more than we could afford at that time. So we went looking farther into Brooklyn, because Brooklyn had rows of beautiful houses. Brooklyn has probably, if you're looking at housing stocks, had at the time certainly the finest urban housing stock probably in the country, I think, in the country.
How come?
It was a rich community built at a wonderful time for communities to be built. Largely it built up after the Civil War, after the 60s and 70s. And so it was a place where people who lived or worked in Manhattan could retreat to. Quiet, not so business, very little business there at that time too. And because the land could be bought cheaply by developers, they built thousands and thousands of beautiful brownstones. All the downtown neighborhoods of Brooklyn were built typically after the 1860s, most of them in the 1870s and 80s.
Did most of the people work nearby? Mm-hmm. Was transportation?
They did not work. It was transportation that took them in there. That is, they usually could take the horse cars, which ran on Flatbush Avenue and streets like that, down to the ferries that went to Manhattan. Mm-hmm. Later on, after 1883, when the Brooklyn Bridge came into being, they could go, the ferries went across the bridge, not the ferries, but the cars, the horse cars ran across the bridge. Later on, of course, those were electrified. But it was fast. Now, it was certainly as easy to get to Manhattan, lower Manhattan, where most of the business was in those days. It was as easy to get there from Brooklyn as it was, let's say, from Manhattan, where the building was going on, also probably maybe even less traffic on the way too. So if you're living on the west side in Manhattan or the east side, particularly it was long to get to downtown Manhattan. In fact, it would be even less if you lived in Brooklyn Heights or Cobble Hill, those areas really downtown Brooklyn. You could be in lower Manhattan faster, as you can, of course, today with the subway, a stop or two away. So that was an attraction to developers to build all those houses. And also, of course, a lot of companies that were making products that would go into those houses were situated in Brooklyn, where costs were much less than they would be in Manhattan.
What products?
Well, cutting the stone, making all the woodwork that went into those into the buildings themselves. Now, those buildings, most of them were cut, a lot of wood, and the products also, and the skills also, make carving, doing the carving, or doing the beautiful plaster work they have inside many of those houses, putting the floors in, the plumbing, all those other things that went into those houses, could be done much more cheaply in Brooklyn than it could be in Manhattan, as they can today. It's cheaper to renovate or fix up a house in Brooklyn than it would be in Manhattan. Anyway, at that time, when we bought our house in Brooklyn, which was 1963, all the old brownstone neighborhoods in Brooklyn were going downhill fast, as they were in Manhattan, too. The whole west side was going downhill very fast, too. Well, There are many social elements. Yeah. Much of what happens in the world today is fashion, isn't that right? That you wear clothes that are in fashion at the time means they're acceptable, and people buy houses that are in fashion, and they make a statement with their houses, or they make a statement with their cars, they buy a Cadillac perhaps, or a Mercedes because it looks good to the neighbors, all those things. So when bounce downs went out of fashion because they were old, because Victorian was a bad word, nobody cared particularly for it, because there was an age when geometry was more important than decoration, so that the people liked flat walls instead of carvings on them. They used to take off the carvings. They didn't particularly like high ceilings when people bought those houses, and they would get lower the ceilings, drop the ceilings, or when the first leak from upstairs, instead of fixing the leak and repairing the ceiling, they would just drop the ceiling. So as these houses became less and less fashionable for people, particularly in Brooklyn, now Manhattan people rarely go to Brooklyn, isn't that true? You yourself almost never go to Brooklyn, you have no reason to. That is not a place where you would live, although the likelihood is that you could get twice as much space for the money that you now pay for whatever you do, for your apartment or anything.
So what happened?
So that people would judge by the fact that Brooklyn was not in fashion. Isn't that right? Fashion again. Fashion means doing what everybody else does. So following the fashion means following what other people do, wearing clothes that are approved, buying houses in neighborhoods that are approved. So this repeats itself. After World War, there was a decline for other reasons also. You didn't have a garage for a car. People had cars and they had to leave them in the streets, so that was a problem too. And so as the houses went down, it became more and more difficult to buy a house. A brownstone anywhere at all, because the houses were old and bankers didn't want to lend on old things. It's very difficult to get a mortgage. So, and then other things, there are many social factors also that contributed. After which, there was a decline in the popularity of brownstones over the years because they were old and American people liked new things also. So, besides the fact of a car, air conditioning came in after a while and all these old houses didn't have enough electricity, although you could install it. And the fact that they were old, people with less education sometimes, didn't like old things. So that was a reason for the decline. After World War II, with the invasion of black people of color, into New York City, into those neighborhoods, the neighborhoods changed, and there was so-called white flight, which was a misnomer, actually. It wasn't white flight. It was flight of the middle class.
This was in the 1960s?
Talking about 1950s, 60s, 70s, all those times.
Okay.
It was a flight of the middle class because the schools became unacceptable at that time.
Okay, let's fast forward. You are looking for another house.
Well, I just want to tell you all the conditions
that
pervaded at that time. That was among the factors of the time that made the houses cheap also, and why a lot of young people did not live in those neighborhoods and went elsewhere. Among the reasons they went elsewhere was the fact that it was so difficult to get a mortgage. Now, I'm a very middle-class person who always manages money carefully, has one job, worked at one place for 33 years, so that's a sign of stability. But we wanted to buy our house. We wanted to buy our house in Park Slope. We went to 12 banks before we could get a mortgage. We were turned down all over. Now, at that time, we could have bought a house in Long Island, North New Jersey, or Westchester for $500 down, or nothing down. So a lot of people who didn't have the cash to buy a house couldn't buy a house there. Now, you had to have a quarter of the price of the house to get a mortgage. We paid $32,000 for our house. To buy that house, we had to have at least $8,000 plus money to move in, plus money to do fixing up necessary, $10,000, $12,000. Most young people didn't have $10,000 or $12,000 cash. In fact, there are young people today with big salaries who don't have $10,000 in the bank, too.
Let's get back to this. How did you find your particular house?
I'm going to get to that.
Okay.
This is all about brownstones and why people didn't buy them and why they came back to them.
Okay.
So that's a whole part. We didn't sell brownstones because they're nice and warm in the winter or cold in the summer or anything. We bought them because they were superior houses, and they didn't buy them because you couldn't buy them for very often. One of the reasons that young people didn't buy houses was that the schools were not good. and so a young person with a couple of kids who could not afford to send his kids to private schools had to leave the city. So New York City exported thousands and thousands of young people who would have preferred to live there. That also made the houses cheap because there was no market for them at the time in many places. We bought our house because a man named Bob Makler in Brooklyn had started a program to sell those. M-A-K-L-A. Robert Makler, M-A-Makler. Who was a man who knew how to promote things. He took an organization in Park Slope, where we bought our house, that had been founded in the 1890s, called the South Brooklyn Board of Trade. He changed the name to the Park Slope Civic Council, and he had the first house tour. I'm not sure whether it was the first house tour of the city or not, but it was that kind of house in 1962. He had what he called the House and Gardens Tour. This was carefully named because he wanted people to know that there were gardens behind those houses. When you bought a moundstone, you also got what had formerly been the backyard, but it could be a garden too, be regarded as a garden.
In proportion, how big was the garden? Half the size of the house, or how big?
The typical moundstone, they're all come in all sizes, but most moundstones are 50 feet long on a 20-foot wide. So the plot itself is 100 feet deep. So the house itself may be set back 10 or 15 feet from its 100 feet in the front. And the back, you probably have a garden that's typically about 30 feet long, 35 feet long, by 20 feet wide. Okay. It's a substantial garden for sitting, as ours is. You can brick it in or grow things in it, and sit out there and enjoy the garden itself. In the olden days when the houses were built, people didn't use them as gardens particularly. But they used them to hang the wash out there, or do things like that.
Kitchen garden.
It was a kitchen garden, or a little kitchen garden where you'd grow tomatoes. But it wasn't people just, I think it was not the sort of thing that people did normally, sitting out in gardens. In our generation now, people love to sit out in their backyards, call them backyards or gardens, whatever it is. We bought our house at the time when we bought our house on Park Slope. It had a little publicity because of what Bob Black was touring. 1962. In 1963, he had another House and Gardens tour. It was a time when most people were looking for apartments rather than buying houses necessarily. So in his House and Gardens tour, he also had a couple of apartments where people bought a floor and about, or not bought, or renting a floor, or renting a part of a floor, or whatever it was. This was particularly appealing to young people, too. Didn't necessarily want to buy a house, but wanted a place to live where they'd get on the subway and go to Manhattan. We went on one of those tours, a House and Gardens tour, given by the Park Slope Civic Council. We got to visit the neighborhood, know a little about it. Then we got word from a friend of ours that there was a house for sale that we might be interested in Park Slope. And we looked at it. It's a beautiful house, very well maintained. They've been turned into many apartments, actually. It's a six-family house.
A legal six-family house. On a floor for
It was a four-story house. The two lower floors were apartments, and then the third and fourth floors had two apartments per floor.
Was there a basement in any of
there
these
was a, there's,
homes?
All of them have basements.
And what were they used for over the years?
Well, the basement was a place where you had a furnace and you had storage. In the olden times, when the houses were built, you stored coal there. You had to have a big place for coal. The furnaces were enormous. The hot water heaters were enormous. So you needed a lot of room.
And what did that evolve into over the years?
Well, our basement is just a big storage place, but you can't really do very much with it normally. Now, legally, the basement is any floor where more than half of it is below street level, or part of it is below street level.
Yeah.
So that legally, in many of these houses, what we think of as the first floor, is actually the basement. So that legally, our house, you have to go down into our lower floor, two steps down.
Right.
So legally, our lower floor, the bottom floor, is called the basement, and then we have a cellar beneath that. So what we think of normally as the basement is really the cellar.
Could you rent that out Or do people do that, make an extra dwelling?
Well, you can, but it's difficult. You have to dig out the whole thing in order to have it deep enough.
No.
If you want to use the cellar, if you want to use the cellar.
The cellar, the basement.
No, well, the basement floor is a real floor, although it's called the basement.
Yeah.
It's called the basement. We live in that. That's our bottom floor. It's two steps down from the street level.
I see.
That is the bottom floor of our house. So we actually have, we think of it as a four-story house, but legally, it is three stories over a basement. And then there is a cellar below that.
I see. But do people make a bedroom or an apartment out of it?
Out of the basement? Of course. They are usually typically rented. A house like ours, if you broke it up into apartments, could be an eight apartment building.
Today, the zoning would allow it?
A lot of them. Well, that's permitted. That's part of it. It's a livable place. The basement is a livable place, yes. It just happens to be slightly below grade.
Okay, yeah. So you went on the house and
we bought. We bought that. We saw our house, which is beautifully preserved. It has six fireplaces, six bathrooms. It has magnificent plasterwork all intact in the house. And many other features of a very well designed, beautiful mahogany carvings, all intact. All those things were intact, even though it had been turned into a larger house. It had been owned for many
years. How high were the ceilings?
Pardon me?
How high are the
They're
ceilings?
They're almost 11 feet 9 inches, 12 feet apart.
Okay.
That's on the parlor floor.
And all
the other floors are 9 feet.
I'm trying to get a picture of this. How many windows? There's a window and then the stairs going up and then a window. What does the front look like?
Well, the front, our front has, there's a doorway to the left. It's a large doorway, beautiful mahogany trim, all that stuff. And it has three windows from our parlor. Our parlor, talking about the parlor floor.
Mm-hmm.
All the floors have three windows fronting the street. But some of them have four windows. The third and fourth floors have four windows because there's one. If you look at the front of this building,
yeah.
There's an entrance over here, and then you go up a stoop into that entrance, which is on the parlor floor. You go up the stoop to the parlor floor. Below that, under the stoop, there's another entrance to the basement level, to the first floor.
Where is the kitchen?
Well,
would you describe the floors?
Well, you have to. There's an original thing, and then there's an original arrangement of these things, and then there's a conversion of these things.
We'll do both.
Well, originally when the house was built, there was a cellar down below.
Yeah.
That's where they put the coal down in, where there's a huge furnace. We have the original furnace. It stands about 7 feet high, an enormous monster thing. And then the rest of it, we have turned it into a laundry also down there. We use a lot of storage space, that sort of thing. But the cellar was a functioning place where you, like a heat and hot water primarily, and
mm-hmm.
use excess storage. Then there is the basement or first floor level. Now, typically in the olden times, that contained a kitchen in the rear, a large kitchen in the rear.
Right, overlooking the garden.
Overlooking the garden,
yeah.
Right in the back. And then there's a hallway. There were actually two thoroughfares leading from the kitchen to the front room, which was the family room.
Yeah.
And that, and one of them was just a walkway through, and then another one was a storage room also. It was lined larger, it was wider, and it was lined with cabinets, where in the old days you kept dishes and groceries and that sort of thing. And that led into the family room in the front, and that was normally where the family ate, and where the kids were taken care of, and they often sat together. This parlor floor, which was the floor at the top of the stoop, when you walked in there, you walked into the parlor floor, you would walk into a hallway which went straight ahead to a set of stairs going up to the floor above. But if you went off to the side somewhere or other, there would be doors. Now, typically those were sliding doors, pocket doors they called, because they slid back into the wall itself. And that would take you into the parlor. That was the entertainment of the place. Usually large, right?
Mm-hmm.
In our house, it's 37 feet long. So it's a good sized room, 12 feet high. So you can have, it's an important room in every possible way. Wonderful plasterwork. That would be typical. All the woodwork is mahogany on that floor. That would be typical too. Some of them might have cherry or something or other, but a lot of wood in those houses. These little houses built in the 1870s and 1880s, which were very elaborate.
And you still have the original?
It's all there. It's all there. And wooden blinds in front that open and close and that sort of thing. And magnificent floors. We have beautiful, beautiful parquet floors, all with beautiful designs. Now that opened, we have a slightly larger house than many of these houses. For example, walking along, we noticed on 80th Street over here, was that where I counted, or was that 79th Street?
80th
Street, where they have rows of 17-foot houses. They're much narrower here. Now, when the houses were sold, typically they were sold at 100-foot widths. A developer would come along somewhere or other in the 1860s or 1870s, they would survey this land and divide it into plots. And they were auctioned off, usually at 100-foot widths. Now, a developer at that point could make a choice. Would he like to put three houses on that, which would be 17 and a quarter feet, or 17 and a third feet wide? Would he like to have five houses 20 feet wide on his 100 feet? Or would he like to have even three houses, three beautiful houses 35 feet, or almost that wide?
We've got a few more floors to go.
Well, and now usually, okay, those are two floors over here. Parlor floor, to the rear of that is the dining room.
The formal dining room.
The formal dining room, right? That was where you entertained the preacher when he came to visit on Sunday.
How did they get the food from the kitchen? The dumbwaiter?
Almost all of these houses had a dumbwaiter also. Now, all these houses were built, they were in Brooklyn, all the parks, for example, in Park Slope. The census of 1890 shows that the average family had two servants.
So you had a cook in the basement
over there cooking, and then you had a maid upstairs perhaps serving the dinner. And in our house and in many of the houses, they also had little signaling operations. They had intercoms in those houses built into them. So the lady of the house could call down and say, bring up the soup, Maggie, and it would come up like that on the dumbwaiter. Now in our house and in many of the houses, we have what was originally a butler's pantry. So the things would come up, be put to the pantry, they would have all the dishes there and so forth, and he might divide it up and put it on dishes. And
how did the dumbwaiter work? Pulling a rope?
A rope. Batted up and down, yes.
I see. What have people done with that space now that they...
Well, in many cases, they're rarely used. In fact, I haven't seen an active dumbwaiter in any of these houses. Of course, the ropes fall and things happen to them. In our case, the dumbwaiter has been turned into, in one case, it's a guest closet on our dining room floor. And it's a utility closet on our first floor.
Mm-hmm.
And upstairs it's just there with no use at all.
And there are no elevators.
Well, in those houses, in some of the very elaborate houses, they did have elevators. Now in our house, somewhere in the 1930s, there was installed something called an inclinator.
Inclinator.
That's
I-N-C-L-I.
Inclinator, right?
Inclinator,
which,
okay.
A company in Pennsylvania that makes those called the Inclinator Company, actually, and they started making them in 1926. Ours was probably installed in the 30s, long after the house was actually built. Our house is an 1886 house, but it was owned by one woman for many, many years, who was a child when the house was built and died as an old lady in that house, too.
What did you do? Where did you carve the space out of to put the elevator
in? It climbs along the stairs.
Put the elevator in, would have been...
Well, an elevator, you need a certain amount of space for an elevator. So
where did you take it from?
This inclinator goes along the stairs themselves. It folds flat against the wall. When you want to use it, it comes out again. You sit on it and press a button and it takes you up to the next floor.
I'm familiar with that.
It doesn't intrude on that. It is like they call them stair climbers today, except that ours was like no stair climber you've ever seen. It was built into the house, it's stained to match everything, and there are no motors that show because it has cables that go down to the cellar.
Do you use it?
We had it totally refinished, and I use it all the time now. Yes, it's beautiful.
Now I'm missing two floors for the
Okay,
top
now,
now
there are two floors. Those are bedroom floors.
What, two bed, one on each side?
Well, actually more. Well, on the third floor, in the typical house, it's hard to visualize this, but where the area taken now by hallways and whatever becomes part of the floor of the bedroom in front of the house itself. So there's a large alcove. on the third, typically on the third floor, and that's usually the master bedroom. That alcove will take a bed, so that you have a bed in an alcove, and then the rest of it is almost like a sitting room, typically in those houses.
Yeah.
And then in the rear, typically, you had another room, another bedroom in the rear, and then often there would be a small room between those two with an entrance, its own entrance into the hall. So that if you had a house like that, the fourth floor would be very much like that. If you had a house like that, Mama and Papa would have the master bedroom in front of the house with the alcove for the bedroom. Then you would have a maid or a nurse take care of the children. And the rear room and the rooms upstairs would be either for a servant or for children. They had bigger families in those days, so you had three or four or five kids. They had room for all the kids also. There would be possibly a couple of small rooms for the help.
Okay. Now, would you talk about the landscaping in the front when you bought it? What does the typical brownstone landscaping when they were first built?
They didn't have landscaping at all.
The
trees would be on the curb, side. There were trees, but not new, normally not on the property itself. Normally not. So you would have, all those houses were built with slate sidewalks. Usually big slabs, maybe 6 or 7 feet square in front of the house. And they would extend those or have other slate slabs going into the house itself. Now, of course, all those houses had a big opening in the sidewalk itself, in front of the house itself, because they had to have a way of delivering coal down below to the house itself.
A coal chute.
So you had to have huge iron doors or wooden doors that opened up so that the man could come around and send the coal down to the cellar where it would be stored. Right.
Did people have window boxes, or were there any flowers, any color, in the old days?
I don't know that they did, but it was not common, or I don't recall seeing pictures. Now, what they did do in those days, originally in the house, most of them had awnings. Those were popular at the time over the houses.
Were they colorful or just blended?
I don't know what the color, but I imagine they were striped for the most part. The popular stripe would have been green and white.
Green and white. Okay.
Would have been the most popular, I think.
Okay. Now, let's update it. What has time done to the typical old brownstone?
Well, because they were unpopular.
Mm-hmm.
And people who could have maintained them the way they were when they were built had largely disappeared or left them to their children who were moving out to the suburbs where you could keep two cars, you'd have a two-car garage for a family with some money. They became less fashionable, of course. These houses tend to be bought by slumlords, but landlord types. We turn them into many apartments and rent them out and make a profit on them that way. That's what happened probably. I don't know what the numbers are, maybe three-quarters of something or other in Brooklyn, downtown, many of the neighborhoods in Manhattan, Upper West Side, Chelsea. I think the Village actually rose above it because it was popular for other reasons. And the Upper East Side had some of that, but not a lot of it, because the people with money were living there and they had a lot of fancy apartment houses which kept the neighborhoods from falling apart. And also, of course, all the movements and all the movements that militated against a proper community pushed people from those areas into other areas that were in better condition. So in Brooklyn, I think parts of Flatbush stayed fairly good, and neighborhoods like Old Borough Park and
Bensonhurst,
or areas like that.
Fort Hamilton.
They stayed fairly stable, pretty much. But now, of course, all the people who wanted to live in the city were moving into those neighborhoods and vacating the old brownstone neighborhoods, which are also more expensive to keep, too, if you had a brownstone house, where it's more gas in many ways. Bigger has also, at a certain age, they become more expensive to maintain, too. You need new plumbing fixing. And you need to update all your electricity. If you buy a new house, it's all built in. The electrical power is built in. In the old house, you have to install it inexpensively, all those things.
What about the taxes? Is there a history of the up and down and up and down?
Well, of course, you can't, by law, you can't change the taxes more than a certain percentage each year, so it's not as if they really went up and went down. But taxes, of course, in all those neighborhoods are very, very low. Mm-hmm. It's one of the attractions. They're ridiculously low. As houses on all one- and two-family houses in New York City are ridiculously low. So very rich people, even in these communities around here, probably pay very low taxes. Certainly on the Upper West Side, they pay very low taxes. Now, for a house like ours in Park Slope, which is worth a lot of money today, maybe $1.5 million, maybe more, we pay about $8,000 a year in taxes. A house like ours of equivalent value in Scarsdale, for example, probably pay about $30,000 a year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, now so let's go
that's
back
a, that's
to...
That's a political thing, by the way.
Yes,
of course.
I realize. Let's go back to how they have upgraded. What would I find that would be different in the house today than it was when they were first built?
Or in many of the houses, right.
Yeah.
You did?
Now, of course, many of the houses, because they get... most of those houses, a very high percentage of them, were rent-controlled, which means people paid ridiculously low rents. So though somebody would buy a house and he had no incentive to do anything better. He did the least he could. Nowadays it's changed because different class of people paying very good rents, and the landlord has an incentive to improve the apartment, to do nice things, to paint frequently, and to fix it up and to maintain it, on and on.
Are they still mostly rental today? Or
I don't know what the percentage
owned?
Is, but a lot of them are rent controlled. In the case of our house, when we bought it, we had four tenants. Actually, when we bought the house, it had six tenants in it. And one for the basement floor, one for the parlor floor, and two each on the third and fourth floors. Now, we got rid of the tenants, or they went very rapidly, on the first and second floors. So we had a duplex in our house, and we had four tenants upstairs. Now, over the years, we've gotten rid of two of the tenants who occupied the rear apartments on the third and fourth floors. And on the third floor now we have a library. We've made a beautiful library. And on the fourth floor we have a guest suite where friends come and visit. So we just have two tenants now in the front, third and fourth floor apartments.
Now, do they use the common staircase to get
out? They use the common staircase.
So they walk through part of your apartment?
No, they don't. See, that's one of the nice things about these houses. The staircases and the halls are all apart from the main floors themselves. So our parlor floor, our parlor actually opens into that common staircase, but it's closed usually all the time. So that
I see.
It's all separate. Actually, the house lends itself very well to being turned into apartments. That's one of the reasons that they've been saved, because they accommodate themselves to small apartments and large apartments. You could live in the whole house, or you could live in one of the eight apartments there. And they make very pleasant apartments, too. Now, in our house, they do, because everything in there is original. And our tenants love that, too. They have a nice fireplace, gas fireplace. And we have the original shutters on the windows and all the sculpture and plasterwork there. And the original walls are lined. All our common hall is all lined with Lincrusta, which is a Victorian material, which has never been painted, all original. Much of our house is original. That's one of the reasons we bought it. The fixtures on our parlor floor are all original gas-burning fixtures, which have been converted to electricity. So they have a quality that's very pleasant.
But now, what have people changed? The 7-foot furnace is probably no longer...
Well, it's unusual, but it works fine, so I would never think of changing it. But most people, over the years now, these houses were all built with a different kind of heating system. They were all built with a warm air heating system, which means that you had a furnace downstairs, they heated the air, and went up through ducts through all the floors above,
mm-hmm.
came out usually through gratings of the floor or the wall, and heated the house that way.
We have no radiators.
We have no radiators, no pipes, no nothing having to do with heating, so it's very nice. But that system was perfect, but it depended on gravity. That is, the warm air rises all the time. Now, that can be very slow, and on a very cold day, let's say if you get above freezing, or get below freezing, rather, often those systems were not sufficient, and the house would be a little chilly. That was why in our house, we had supplementary gas fireplaces. you turn on the gas burner, which we do occasionally,
mm-hmm.
to warm the house or to give a little extra heat if we need it. But many people, back then, you know, there were salesmen selling things all over. And back in the turn of the century, there were people selling steam systems and hot water systems. And because many people could found that their original heating system, warm air heating system, was not competent to deal with the problem, they would install steam systems with radiators and all the attendant mm-hmm. nuisance of those things. Later on, somewhere in the 20s, I suspect it is maybe the 30s, I'm not sure of the date, they started installing large fans as part of the furnace system, which is
ceiling?
What we have. No, it's a fan connected to the furnace itself that pumps air through the furnace so that instead of the furnace depending on a very slow movement of air, warm air moving up, this now gives it a high push so the air circulates very rapidly, and that actually heats the whole house very well without any further problem. So you had to have, somebody had to design a huge fan. The fan is 5 feet across, and it's contained in a huge metal shell.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody had to do that. So in our house, we have the superior heating system. It's not, has no pipes, no nothing, and it's very effective. The house is warm.
What do you do mm-hmm. for a garage?
Well, now, of course, we do what, well, many people do what they do in Manhattan, too. If you know, if you have a car, you leave it in the street and park. Do it across and move it from side to side. We actually have a public garage we keep it in. So we have it, and when we want our car, we call up and they bring the car to us. Now, of
so
course,
nobody has their own garage because of the way
they
grow.
They're rare. They were not built for cars. Now, here and there, as there is in Manhattan, there are little places where you would keep your horses or your carriage or whatever.
The
stable. Carriage house.
Mm-hmm.
Carriage house, right. So there are some of them here and there. They have a lot of them, I know, in Manhattan also, which are, have been turned into houses, actually. And some of them in Brooklyn have been turned into a little apartment, little building.
Now, were there changes in the kitchen?
Well, of course, all the kitchens are all modernized. It's a very different kitchen. The kitchens originally were wood-burning kitchens. They had a wood-burning stove, and it had its own little chimney to send
the
fumes
stove,
up there.
Yeah.
They had running water, but the, and running hot. When the house was built, I'm sure they had running hot and cold water in the house. But the stove was different. Didn't have refrigerators, of course. They had ice boxes in those days, so somebody had to carry the ice in and bring leave it out. And the houses were not as efficient. Now, first of all, people didn't own as many things as they do today. So unless you were very rich, you didn't have all sorts of containers of one kind or another to worry about. And you were going to say.
I was going to say, why don't you tell your part in making this happen with the Rockefeller visit?
What I'm just about to say is that...
I got
what I'm giving you is what you can read in the book about brownstone. Do you know much about these things, brownstone?
Somewhat.
Well, what I'm telling you is what it exists in books, but that doesn't have very much to do with me, just the way they were. Now, if you want a description of brownstones, or you want me to tell you about what my partner did, something else.
Well, that's my next chapter.
Okay,
now, how did you get involved beyond just buying a house and living in it?
I'm an editor and writer by trade. I work for besides other publishing houses, I work for Popular Science magazine for 33 years, and that's what I did. That's what I've done for most of my professional life, editing and writing and so forth.
A little louder.
Okay, and I started as an assistant editor at Popular Science, and I retired as editor of the magazine, the editor of the magazine, after many years. Evelyn and I bought our house in August of 1963. At that time, there was Park Slope Civic Council, which I mentioned before,
mm-hmm.
was sponsoring tours.
With Bob Macklin.
Bob Macklin.
He's been around since, hasn't he?
Yeah. He's still around. He was a big park man. He had a major role in promoting park service,
mm-hmm.
and volunteer services in the park. I went to...
Wait a minute. Okay. Your involvement.
In the fall of the year when we bought our house, we attended a meeting of the Park Slope Civic Council, members meeting. It was held in a hall somewhere or other, I forgot the church.
And these were the local owners?
Local people, right, meeting together. It was a small meeting, small group. Very few people had moved into it. I think when I took a picture of the pioneers of Park Slope, maybe a year or so later, we assembled maybe 40 or 50 people on one big stoop, and I took one big picture of everybody who, the new people who had come to Park Slope.
Mm-hmm.
Community with thousands of residents. But at that meeting, they were planning a house tour for the next year, and they were wondering how they could get publicity. And because I know something about these things, you can write press releases and take pictures, all that sort of thing, I volunteered to start doing publicity for the community, which I did. So over the years, for a long time, I would publicize every house tour that came along. And that expanded and expanded and became more and more of an occupation at the time. What I did at the time, and this was something that evolved over the years, I would dress up several people in period costumes, like my wife, stand her up in front of one of these brownstones and send it away, send the picture away. In those days, the World Telegram was still printing and the Mirror was still alive, and they were receptive to photographs like that, so we got additional publicity that way. That was one thing. Now, among other things, somewhere around that time, probably 1965 or somewhere or other, a friend of ours, Joe Ferris, called me up to tell me, his name was Ferris, F-E-R-R-I-S, Ferris, as in Ferris wheel. At that time, all the houses, as they were being vacated, were being bought up by developers, people who turned them into all sorts of things, you know, SRO, standing room only, so-called, you know, where you just sell somebody a room and put a new lock in it so they could...
Single
room occupancy. Yeah. So it was even worse than turning it into apartments, or more so. And of course, the key to maintaining those neighborhoods...
Wait,
I'm going to turn mine over now. All I do is just turn over like this.
Right. And this is turning... I'm afraid I don't know how to open it. Okay, you were saying.
While we were there, a few years before, a lot of people who had been buying those houses had no intention of living in them, but turning them into little modules of one kind or another, and then bringing in anybody they could. So the neighborhood had been deteriorating, and the quality of the houses had been deteriorating. They were poorly maintained. There was almost no money in them. So a lot of the best houses were being ruined that way by absentee landlords who bought them up. And that was at a time when a friend of mine, Joe Ferris, told me of a house that was being for sale. That was a magnificent house on 6th Avenue. It was inhabited by an old doctor, Dr. Doyle, who had a younger wife. She wanted to get out of Park Slope, which was deteriorating.
D-O-Y-L-E?
D-O-Y-L-E, right.
Okay.
Because the neighborhood had been deteriorating, she wanted to get out. This was a house that was lined with walnut paneling in the whole place. It was a beautiful jewel of a house on 6th Avenue.
In Brooklyn.
This is Brooklyn. Somewhere near, I guess it would have been near, Park Place. Somewhere around that neighborhood, on 6th Avenue. It was for sale for $16,000. Now that was a very cheap price even then. Now most people were buying houses. We brought lots of friends of ours to Park Slope to look at our house, and they bought houses. And the going price at that time for a very good brownstone on a very good block was somewhere $22,000, $23,000, $25,000. And this one was much cheaper. We paid more for our house, $32,000, because it was more elaborate, had more original linings or whatever it was, decorative elements still there. We paid $32,000. Anyway, it was for sale. And so Joe and I got together, we agreed, we found a couple more friends who were interested in doing something about this house. Doing something meant actually getting somebody to buy it who would respect it and live in it happily. Eventually, we did find a very nice young couple who bought the house.
A single tenant.
Well, not a tenant, a single buyer.
Buyer.
To buy that.
Live in it.
Right, though the Pierce, what's their name again? Anyway, they bought this house. So there were four of us who had got involved in this.
Gillen.
Huh?
Gillen.
No. Be able to pee. Anyway, we found someone to buy that house. And then we found a few more people, and we thought we would form a little rescue organization to buy up houses cheaply and then find people, the right people to buy them. Because most of these houses were not, they'd come on sale, nobody would come up on the market, nobody would know that they were there. Desirable people, in our meaning of desirable, didn't know about these things, so they were not bought. They were just bought by the people who bought them up and
broke into a park.
A neighborhood, a changing neighborhood. So we agreed to form an organization to do that. So that was what we all. We started an organization to see that the proper people, or people we wanted, would buy those houses. And that meant a lot of publicity to get this going. So
but
we
there
did,
were only six of you originally.
Actually, we started with four, and then we got some more. Eventually, we ended up with 10. And we gave it a name, Park, very unimaginative name, Park Slope Betterment Committee. Publicize it. Because I was a publicist, though I knew about what to do this, we got a lot of publicity. And this started in many, many ways. First of all, I sent out press releases, which nobody ever did before, to all the newspapers, and we sent out pictures. And then we organized tours in addition to the annual tour given by the Park Slope Betterment, by the Park Slope Civic Council. We organized our own special tours. And that means every time we found a house that had been bought by somebody or other in some community that we wanted to publicize, for example, we would say, this part of 6th Avenue needs heavy promotion. We would have a tour of houses in that community, half dozen houses. And the themes of those changed. Now, the first themes we started with were, believe it or not, houses you can buy for $20,000. What we did was get a list of all the houses that were for sale around there. And there were a lot of houses for sale. People were getting out. So we would have somebody make a list, go to all the real estate people, and there were not many at the time, make a list of all the houses that were for sale.
Did you charge for these tours?
No, we paid this ourselves. All free. All the expenses we paid ourselves too. We would chip $10 a piece into a pot. When that got used up, we would put in more money. All the work was done ourselves. And everybody who came to those tours, after a while there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, we started what you can buy for $20,000. People would go to those houses and look at them. Now, a lot of them were not beautiful houses or not in good shape, but nonetheless, others were encouraged to find that somebody had ladders up and paintbrushes out and was working on them, and they would look at the house and they would understand the value of those houses. So we had a series of tours starting with what you can buy for $20,000. As prices went up, $25,000, what you can buy for $30,000 in all those communities.
What age people were coming in?
All young. All young.
Well educated.
Now, we publicized.
What we would call yuppies today?
Well, they were the kind, yeah, but these were very stable people looking for homes, houses, so not what you might think of, or yuppies maybe. Anyway, we found after a while, we kept lists, card files of everybody who came on a tour at all. So we'd always know who he was, and he would get a notice. Now the notice was list on one side all the houses that were for sale at that time. On the other side, it would list all the things that were going on in Park Slope. It was a time of ferment in the community, and block parties had been started up in a number of blocks. And so we would list the block parties, summertime list the block parties that were going on, all the other things. There was a concert of some kind or other in one of the churches, listening, all the neighborhood things.
Was there a community newspaper, like Our Town or something?
No, nothing like that at the time.
Okay.
We all did it ourselves, and then we had this mailing list. We grew and grew and grew. We would have envelope signing, writing parties, get four or five people sitting around a couple tables. I would address 500 or 600 letters. Evelyn was a big signer. I was known as a licker.
licking the envelope. That went on for a long, long time. We did that. It was a major promotion. Now what we did was we went after all the young people in Manhattan. And the story was, for what you would pay for a two-room apartment in Manhattan, you can buy a house in Brooklyn. Now we appealed, which was true. So we got a lot of people who would normally not have thought of buying a house in New York City at all. So these were, we got school teachers, artists, young people, the prep professions, all those people, family people of all kinds, typically.
Mm-hmm. And bankers and lawyers.
Young bankers and lawyers. Now, those days, there were a lot of bankers and lawyers didn't make all the big money that they make now. But all, now, later on, we made a study. We found, we made a study of the people who bought houses during those years, virtually all of them college graduates. A very high percentage of them had further degrees, graduate studies, or whatever.
When you say those years, how many years are we talking about?
We're talking probably from years of 5 years, 1966, 67, into the early 70s, where we had those tours of all kinds, where we were doing heavy promoting all those times.
Was still the original group of four?
Well, it changed somewhat or other now. Joe Ferris eventually bowed out. I was the guy who ran the thing for a long time. I ran this organization for a long time. It was very effective. We did get thousands of people coming in. Now, what we would do also in those times, we were very friendly with the guy, Father Buck of B-U-C-K. What was his name? Clifford Buck.
Okay.
Who was the priest of the local Episcopal Church. Right. Very helpful to us. So he let us use the whole undercroft of the church for our meetings of one kind or another. And it was a large area, probably, mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe 50 by 60 feet, something of the kind, very large. And we would set up stations in there. So every time we had a tour, this was the pattern. You would come on the tour, you would start at a certain place to see the tour. You would go from house to house to house. At the end somewhere, there would be a place where you could talk to people. They would serve lemonade and cookies or whatever. So at the end of the tour, you could talk to people there and have a neighborly feel about it. It was a nice, they felt that there was a community there. Then in the undercroft of St. John's Church, we set up stations. So there would be a station there for lawyers. You could find out what's involved in that. A station where the banker talking about mortgages, somebody talking about the school, somebody like, this was something I learned in the Army. You know, they used to call them
the service station.
Right. Well, they had a name for it in the Army, which I've forgotten now. But where you want to teach something, you have specific groups and people walk around. Exactly like that. And now, so we did that for a long time. That was all very successful. We were selling houses, people were buying houses at a great rate.
We were not selling.
No, we never sold. I never bought any house other than my own. Now, a major problem at that time was getting mortgages for these houses.
Well, you had that problem years before.
Well, yeah, and almost didn't get it. A lot of people were turned away because they couldn't get a mortgage or they didn't have enough money for it or whatever. A lot of desirable people. So at that point, we made a survey of all the people who had bought houses in our community. As I said, virtually all the college graduates, people with very responsible jobs of one kind or another, young people, who all had trouble getting mortgages, all had trouble. So we did two things. First of all, we wrote, with this survey, we wrote to David Rockefeller, who was then head of Chase Bank, mm-hmm. told him why nobody was getting a mortgage from Chase Bank. How come? We got a very nice letter from the vice president of Chase in charge of mortgages. So we went up there and we made a presentation, four or five of us, a presentation there. We had all the figures of who these people were, and the desirability of those houses, the desirability of bringing people like that into New York City instead of exporting them to the suburbs. The man we spoke to, a man named Sawyer, S-A-W-Y-E-R, was very responsive to what we said. And one of the things about our houses was, you know, these were...
Mm-hmm.
These houses were... Anyway, we made a presentation of this man there.
for you.
And one of the things going for us was the fact that all the people came to these houses were there, people looking for the old features that these houses had. They were not tired of them. So when after we told this to Sawyer, we were explaining to him the difficulty of getting mortgages and how the people, the appraisers from the bank, would often turn their thumbs down on the houses. So he called in his chief appraiser. And he said, now, these people are all interested in buying brownstones. What do you think of that? And the man said, oh, you know, they're great houses. You just get rid of that old stuff there, and you're all set. So the moment he heard it, he understood a problem that the appraisers had with our houses. They regarded the old stuff as a minus factor. And we thought this is why people are coming in to buy those wonderful old houses. So as a result of that, very soon after that, Chase Bank committed itself $100 million in mortgages to old neighborhoods in New York City. So that opened the gates. Now, another thing that we did at the same time, because banks were not cooperating with us in giving mortgages, there was we had a big discussion about that. We thought, well, should we picket them, do all those things? And instead, we decided to go the other way, but to make friends. So we had a cocktail party for them. Now, one of the members of our group was a rich banker who had a beautiful house covered with fancy paintings and all sorts of things, living the way, you know, a rich person would live. And that's where we had our party. Now, the bankers who came there, representatives, I don't know how many banks, but it was quite a party. Bankers go where they get free liquor. Anyway, the environment impressed them. And at the same time, we gave them a message. We gave them exactly the same thing we had. We had charts up showing how many people were this and how many people worked in that and what the educational level and the financial level. Obviously, they made more than average people did with their education and whatever. So that was very appreciated. But the best thing about that was we got names of people of different banks. And thereafter, when somebody had trouble getting a mortgage for his house, he could call me up. And I would call up somebody, banker. I'd say, look, this guy here can't get a mortgage. He's being turned down by three banks. Can you do something? It was very effective. Mm. So we eventually solved the mortgage problem. And,
today what happens when you meet somebody you don't know?
Oh, well, that's another thing. You know, over the years now, this is all 20, 25 years ago or so. Occasionally, as I did about 2 weeks ago, I was in our little copy shop getting some copy, and some guy came up, aren't you Mr. Orton? I said, yes. I said, do I know you? He said, you were the guy who got me a mortgage 25 years ago.
Like
awesome.
That was very terrific.
Anyway, that's one of the nice things now, in the area of promotion. Now, we had evolved over a period of time a program for publicizing and reviving a community. You know, that you did this thing, sort of thing. You had to give house tours of a particular type. We told everybody who came, you got on the card somewhere, that you knew something about them. You gave them a chance to educate himself about the community and about the houses and what he should know on and all those things. There was a procedure. We had something, a 10-part procedure. Now, other communities came to us also. So they could come on one of our tours, and they could get an education in how to do this, how we promoted it, gave them samples of our releases so they could model them after that, and they started doing that in several other communities. As a result, yes.
How large a community that you serviced are we talking about? 10,000 homes?
Well, Park Slope had, I've gotten how many houses?
It was about 180,000 people.
People, a lot of people. I don't know, maybe 10,000 or 8,000 mm-hmm. homes. It's a large community. Okay. Park Slope ranges from Flatbush Avenue on the north to Prospect Expressway, which is about 17th Street on the south. And on the east, it goes from Prospect Park over west to 4th Avenue. So that's an area probably of 5 or 6 blocks wide by 20 blocks long, maybe 100 square blocks, mm-hmm. something like that.
Mm-hmm. It was like Greenwich Village at one point. They had some stuff, right?
Would you repeat what you said?
Well, now, of course, the community has expanded into a larger area where people can fit, or real estate people sell houses which are not really in the old Park Slope, but are given Park Slope names or one thing or another. Mm-hmm. Anyway,
as a result of all this, because we were serving a larger community or were interested in doing it, we formed a citywide organization called the Brownstone Revival. It was originally called Brownstone Revival Committee, renamed more recently Brownstone Revival Coalition. And that's the name of this organization, which still exists, and which still puts out a newsletter, which copy of which I have here for you, so you can see. And what we started doing was, we got an office in Manhattan. Because people from Manhattan don't go to Brooklyn, but people from Brooklyn will go to Manhattan for whatever reason there is. And the man who helped put us all together was Ken Patton, P-A-T-T-O-N, who was then...
Economic something.
Yes, right.
Economic development.
Originally it was a council or something like that formed by Mayor Lindsay. And he got us an office in his place there, so we could meet there and have an address in Manhattan. Also, he taught me a lesson, too. He said, in order to have this organization work permanently, you need to have a paid employee. If you depend entirely on volunteers, they work this week, they don't, they get old, they get sick, and the continuity, the possibility of continuity is lessened. He got a grant or he got money somewhere or other, I guess it was from the Economic Development Council. He was chairman of Economic Development, something or other, but he was also vice president of the Economic Development Council. So they supported us for a long time in that way. We had got a permanent employee so we could put out a newsletter. And also started a series of public meetings. So our first lecture on brownstones was the Brownstone Architecture. It's held at the Donnell Library, you know that, on 53rd Street.
Opposite Museum Modern Art.
The Donnell Library is still there now.
Yeah.
So they seat, or they did at that time, 299 people. Mm-hmm. The first lecture we gave was given by Clay Lancaster, who was a well architectural historian. We were mobbed. They couldn't see. They were lining all the rails around there. There was the beginning of this brownstone frenzy, the mania, where people suddenly were looking for brownstones and finding them. It was a crazy time.
What year was
this? This was probably about 1969, 1970, okay. Somewhere around that time. So that started us off on a series of lectures. And for many years, we have two lectures each year at the Donnell Library, and we did until last year where we gave the last of our Donnell Library lectures, because the subject is not as exciting right now as it was 20 years ago when it was a new world. Well, I think one of the things was, at the time, there was a possibility of people with little money or not so much money buying a house. Now all these houses go for millions of dollars. So, and the people who could afford them have them or can buy them. And so it's changed. Also now everybody has the message. Everybody knows these are good. They're in the newspapers all the time. New York Times puts big articles about them. Mm-hmm. So it has changed. But we did that. We had one, and we also had a wonderful lecture by, what's the name of your famous professor from...
Henry Russell Hitchcock,
who was one of the great gurus of preservationism or whatever. He gave one of our lectures also.
And Jim Fitch.
And James Marston Fitch, also one of the great gurus of...
F-I-T-C-H.
Right, mm-hmm. F-I-T-C-H. They were among the early people who lectured at our series and drew crowds of people. That was another thing we did. And we expanded at that time. Now, we put out our newsletter here. Mm-hmm. Originally, sure, within a year or so after we founded the Brownstone Revival Coalition, we had almost 2,000 members from nowhere, from nothing at all. People just came to the lectures and became members or heard about it, became members.
What were the charges for membership?
Well, at that time, it was $25.
Mm-hmm. But you got a publication.
And they got invited to our lectures and that sort of thing. And now, of course, we're down to about 600 members, but the organization still exists. And I have, well, off and on, I edited the newspaper, newsletter. But for the last 10 years, or 15 years, I guess, I've done this alone. And this is the last one I'm going to edit. I've announced that we have to get somebody else to do these things. So anyway, there's a present for you.
Daddy.
And so,
it'll go with
you. Okay, well... Mm-hmm. So this was all part of promotion. Now, around 1971 or 72, Brooklyn Union Gas Company got involved with us.
it happened this way. They were looking for an old house in which they could install modern gas equipment for demonstration purposes. And they bought a house in a community adjoining Park Slope. Actually, it was Heights, right, not far away. And the community rose up in arms against having a demonstration house there. They visualized hundreds of people coming through the community and all this other traffic, which they didn't want, on and on and on. So they passed resolutions and did all the things to dissuade the Brooklyn Union from doing that. We heard about that. And on our block, we live on Berkeley Place. On Berkeley Place, on the next block between 7th and 8th Avenues, there was a house that had been in litigation for many, many years and had turned into a real wreck. The windows were broken and pigeons were living there and the roof leaked and everything bad about that house was bad. So we got, Evelyn and I got hold of those two people. Actually, there were two men from there, public relations men from Brooklyn Union. And we proposed that they buy that house and restore it, which they did over a period of time. I think they bought it for $17,000, as I recall, right, something like that, in that neighborhood. It was a very successful project for them, enormously. People passed through by the hundreds. Evelyn designed the house. She furnished it, designed what happened to it, all those things. So it was really a model house. And it had gas equipment there. You know, they had a couple of gas lights burning there to give it a few little Victorian charm, that sort of thing. Anyway, it was enormously successful, and Brooklyn Union Gas Company won the National Award from the American Gas Association for the best publicity project in the country. So it really paid off for them. That encouraged them to do something else. There was another man, Hendricks. Hendricks. He was forming a little coalition somewhere or other in Brooklyn also, which was the Brooklyn Brownstone Conference, and I was heavily involved with that.
Well, what's the purpose of that?
To get people together in common causes. So we did. So among the things, he put on little projects of his own, a Brooklyn Brownstone Conference, and we actually had in 1971, we had an enormous brownstone ball, which was held at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. They had a big space, and Brooklyn Academy of Music was just coming to life at that time. So it was good for them and good for us at the same time. But we had proposed to Brooklyn Union Gas Company that we have a brownstone fair. They take a space somewhere or other and put up exhibits from all the different brownstone communities that would attract people. So Brooklyn Union Gas Company agreed to try it on an experimental basis. We took a floor in the hotel on Montague Street. You know, it's that old hotel that is now it's an old hotel. We took a floor in that, or they took a floor in that, and we arranged a series of exhibits over there with representatives of some of the communities there. It was enormously successful. So the next year, I think that was 1972, Brooklyn Union Gas Company had its headquarters in Brooklyn on Montague Street. And it was a block deep, actually, went on to the next street, which was Pierpont Street. And the next year, I think it was 1972, they vacated that entire floor. And they built little booths all along, 80 booths there. Every community in Brooklyn had a booth there. And then they had booths for all the insurance companies and banks and police and health departments. Everybody who had anything to say about Brooklyn had a booth there.
What year was that?
1972. In addition to that, they had a fleet of buses, 6 buses, going out to different communities. So, for example, if you want to see what the Fort Greene neighborhood was like, you'd get on a Fort Greene bus. Go and get on a bus going to Bedford-Stuyvesant, bus going to Park Slope, bus going to all the half dozen different communities. With a tour leader on each, or rather, you would go there, and there'd be a tour guide waiting for you. You get a tour of the neighborhood, come back. And then an hour and a half later, when you came back, you'd go on another tour, so you could see a couple of different communities.
Wow.
Those fairs ran for 7 years. They were weekend fairs, Saturday and Sunday. And we clocked 1 year, I think it was maybe the third or fourth year where we were doing that, we clocked 25,000 people coming through that fair. That's how many.
Over the weekend.
Over a weekend. So if you were interested, coming from Manhattan and buying a house, now the houses are then going up in price. I'm talking about $65,000, $75,000, $80,000, $100,000, going up steadily in price as they became popular and as people came to know them. And of course, now as more and more people got to have friends in those communities. Now, I worked for Popular Science, as I said, for many, many years. When I went to work there, not one person, we had a staff of 35 people, not one of them lived in Brooklyn. I was the only one who lived in Brooklyn. Almost all of them lived outside of Manhattan. I think two or three of them might have lived in the city itself. They were all suburban people. That was true of many white collar jobs at people themselves living outside, unless they were clerical types. So, with the tours itself, we had an enormous. Now, Brooklyn Union also did a lot of advertising. They had commercials come to the fair this week. All those things, promoting. And they also made a movie. It was called Cinderella Berkeley Place, which was about that house, showing it in its original state and what it had turned out to be. And they made a couple. They made another film also, Brownstones of Brooklyn. And then another one also, I forget. That was the other one about the one at our, because they were doing so well on this, they were very interested in doing other things. There was one block, what was that block or other, which had turned into an old mattress block. You know, I don't know if you know what those, you're not old enough to recall what those were like, but if people had old mattresses, they would throw them onto that block, garbage block. So they had actually restored a couple of buildings over there, and then they put in the Brooklyn Union headquarters there, building to promote things. So you could go, an information headquarters, they put on that block, restoring the whole block. It was beautiful, and they made a movie out of that. So with all that promotion, we had a major commotion in New York, and people came and bought houses.
From all over, actually.
Now, I remember getting letters from people. You know, they would get a copy of the Brownstone over here, or they would hear my name. We would get letters from them saying, hey, we're in Iowa now. We expect to come to New York next year. How do I buy a Brownstone? We had a couple of people in Paris, members who got special stamps on it because we had a mail Brownstone to Paris, all those things.
Mm-hmm.
So it stirred a lot of things. Now, as a result of that, we expanded still further. It occurred to us, because we had a program in New York that was so successful in stimulating buying of an old neighborhood and bringing that old neighborhood alive again, that we thought we would go national.
Wait a minute. Your voice is going to me.
Is it?
Jim, why has
we
your
memory... We were talking about the parties, or the fairs. We called the Brownstone Fairs, the Brooklyn Union Gas Company, which was so enormously successful. They ended after 7 years for reasons that had nothing to do with the success of the fairs, because they were always very successful. But the man who promoted it, the man named Fred Rider from Brooklyn Union Gas, R-I-D-E-R, had promoted it, retired. And he was succeeded by a guy who was not interested in that kind of revival. So Brooklyn Union ceased sponsoring the fairs, although they continued for a period having some small interest in it, and then that too died. Because at that point they had a president of Brooklyn Union who was looking toward... had different ambitions for the company. He wanted to expand it. They changed the name to Keyspan Energy and did various other things. The look ceased to be directly toward Brooklyn itself, but they had a larger outlook for the company itself.
Mm-hmm.
So Brooklyn Union ceased to be part of our partnership in that. Now, a couple of things I was going to mention along the way.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that has contributed to the destruction of the Brownstone in all the cities, and mostly, but very heavily in Brooklyn, was a demolition program subsidized by the United States government. As part of a Model Cities program under President Johnson.
Was this HUD?
It was a separate operation. I believe it was separate.
they were subsidizing the demolition of houses in New York. Now, the pattern was something like this. As you know, many of the old neighborhoods, both in New York, the Bronx particularly, destroyed parts of Manhattan by people who came in during the black invasions in New York City. A lot of crime, and there were people there who were totally irresponsible. So they destroyed things. And the houses, because they were old and because they were easily divided into apartments and fell into the hands of people who made money, even out of the worst conditions, were deteriorating rapidly. Now, a typical pattern was this. A house, after a while, would become unlivable. That is, people would tear the walls apart, they'd do this, they'd burn the house, set fire to it, nobody living in there. Then some vagrants would come in there, and they would set fire to it in the course of eating their food or whatever it was, or shooting dope. Anyway, so after a while, a house would become unlivable. And then a man from the building department would come around and say, this house is dangerous, should be demolished. And then there was a whole demolition program. There was a department of demolition in the city, which would handle the demolition. Now, typically in New York City and probably other places, if you had one house that was in bad condition and you tore it down, you then created a lot. Mm. And that lot became a receptacle for garbage and old carriages and mattresses and people and whatever it was. And that would start destroying the block. Even if you had a good house next to it, you would want to get out. So you would send your house to some guy who would then run the house the way he'd run a preceding house that would eventually get destroyed. The houses would be sold for nothing. They were just warped. People abandoned them. And the city took over. And the city didn't take care of them. All those things would happen. So there was a department of demolition. So the thing was to keep that first house from being demolished, to save a block, to save a block. Now, we had a friend, or a guy we knew well anyway, who was head of the department of demolition in the city. That was,
Rick?
No. He was a guy we knew.
Sam
Azadian, right. Azadian. Head of Department of Demolition. He's one of the things that created by Mr. Lindsay, created little departments and all his friends got jobs. So Sam Azadian was, which is true. Sam Azadian was head of that department, and we knew him well. I knew him well. Anyway, I got him to give us a list of all the houses to be demolished, where they were. But that's by that time, we're talking about middle 70s or whatever it was, maybe even earlier than that, probably. And we would look at the list, several of us, communities that we knew, streets that we knew that were still pretty good. So we would call up somebody. If we had somebody over there we knew well, call them up and say, hey, this house is being threatened, see what you can do. Usually it was useless. Because not only was the considered a good thing to tear down those old houses, but it gave employment to a lot of people who had no skills otherwise.
So these were brownstones.
They're beautiful houses, one-time beautiful houses. So these brownstones being torn down for the most part in these old communities, and people did not consider it a waste at all. Well, we're just getting rid of these, we'll be replacing with better housing. Now, the possibility of replacing them with better housing, if you think in terms of living space, bigger rooms, high ceilings, some civilized things about it, and they adapted themselves very well to modern apartments, but nonetheless they were going very fast. So we would try to get the word to somebody in those communities who could save them. There was a small group in Bedford-Stuyvesant springing up to try to do something, and other communities we had friends. We tried that. Now, a couple times when a house, for example, in our own community in Park Slope, which was at that time doing fairly well, but nonetheless there was a house on
Park Place? Really?
I forgot where it was that we tried to say. It was one where they built a new house in its place, you know, the one that comes right off Flatbush Avenue. Anyway, there was a house that was in fairly good condition, actually.
Okay.
And was scheduled for demolition. So we talked to the contractor. We gave him $100 to just hold off for a day while we had a lawyer friend go into court and try to save it. But the guy who owned it lived someplace else and long ago lost interest in it, on and on and on. Well, although we tried to save it, we couldn't. We lost a couple of other houses like that. Now, the city got $5,000 as a subsidy for tearing it, for demolishing a house, which was the cost of it. So the city paid for the demolition. For about $1,000, we could have saved the house. We could have put stone blocks or concrete blocks in the windows, blocked up the whole thing so nobody could get in, and it would have stood there waiting for a better time. And better than that, though, it would have saved it from being an empty lot that would collect garbage and destroy it. There was no interest in doing that at all. No interest. So thousands and thousands of very good houses were destroyed, later replaced by public housing. And you know the fate of public housing, much of it anyway. So that was one of the programs we had that did not work. But it was also part of the feeling at the time that if you just got rid of those old houses, you would do better. There was a feeling also that kids born into old houses would automatically be committed to crime. If only we could put them in nice, new, modern houses, then they would live lives, worthy lives, instead of being criminals. Anyway, that was one of the things we did. Now, let's see. I think I've covered much of what I, of course, we had block parties all the time going on there, and Evelyn was a major dual. In fact, we have a wonderful sign down in our cellar. It's about 8 feet long. It says Brownstone Cafe. No, we would put it in front of one of these houses, put up the sign, and then people would cook chickens and make food. We'd put out, get tables and things, make party, make life a big party, which was part of it.
Yeah.
Well, and as a funny thing now, just as an aside, our block parties, and let's say on our street, Berkeley Place, we used to have a couple of block parties every summer. For a long, long time. Bring people around, have fun, kids would have things to do, on and on and on. It was one way of just having fun in the neighborhood, people meeting people. And in those days, everybody among the pioneers of everybody was a community of people interested in preserving the community. So I remember at that time we had our Berkeley Place block party. Now we funded this, whatever costs there were, if there were any, like sending out invitations, all those things. Everybody put $1 in the pot. That's how we did it. Now, because we got some publicity out of all this thing, I was invited to go to 63rd Street, where they were in the east side, where they were forming a block association. I don't know why they thought they needed one, but they did. So there were all those people talking about one thing, and there was one woman there. She was the wife of a man who had been
very
secretary
famous.
Of the army or something like that, very rich. So I sat with her while they were having a discussion, and she said to me as an aside, she said, "You know, our house is the only one here that has an indoor pool."
Wow.
And then they discussed, well, how much should we put? So somebody said, well, should we put in $75 a piece? And everybody said, sure. So now, I was thinking about $1 a piece people in Berkeley Place. But also, one of the things we saw, we had among the mottos we had, was that you can live in a house like a millionaire on 63rd Street. A school teacher can live in a house on Park Slope, the same house that a millionaire lives in on 63rd Street. Now, actually, it would often be a better house, because people on the Upper East Side had a lot of money. They could call an architect to remove all the decorative stuff and paint the wood, all paint over the wood, and put in different windows. And down here, we look at those windows over there. They've got these enormous windows that have nothing to do with the original. There are 12 panes or 14 panes. You put in little balconies, all those things. So in case there is some architecture, the old architecture to be preserved, people with rich don't preserve them. They destroy it. They have their architect. But the poor people in the poorer neighborhoods, what they do, even the poorest class of buyer in those houses who turns them into rooming houses does nothing. He just drills holes in the wall, in the doors, so he can put in another lock, yet another lock. Otherwise, he doesn't spend any money on the house. So the houses are preserved pretty well. Well, many of them are preserved pretty well.
Back to the city.
Okay. So those are all the things that came along the way in a long career of preserving brownstones and doing what we could to bring people in. Of course, we've now brought more people in than we need in the neighborhoods. And when you walk through Park Slope and all the adjoining communities, it's lovely. Civilized people now, Evelyn and I bought our house in 1963 on a big commercial street. It was probably, well, the stores, probably a third of them vacant, maybe a quarter of them. Vacant, empty.
No babies.
No children anywhere. People with children were moving out. They didn't stay there because the schools were impossible. We brought in friends from outside, nice liberal people we met in Manhattan. We went to a party, come visit us, and they want to buy a house. Well, if you had children, school-aged children coming to Park Slope, the schools were intolerable. We had some friends who put their kids in school for a year and then took them out, sent them to a private school. Now, if you could not afford a private school, you couldn't live in the neighborhood. So all those nice people who would have been middle-class people, who would have been wonderful citizens of New York, we exported to other communities, exported them to wherever they went, wherever the schools were better. And, of course, there was a policy at the time of busing black kids in. So they bussed them in, and that, in case the schools were even halfway tolerable, turned them all black. Now, our friends, little Andrew Marshall went to a school like that for 1 year. The kids had bad experience. If they had bicycles, they lost them. If they had money, they were shaken down. So all these things happened at the time. All those things made neighborhoods more difficult to live in. So you had to have people willing to overcome those problems. Now, of course, we have a couple of schools that are pretty good. And our high school, local high school, which has been up all black up to now, is in the process of being made into something else. So everybody can go there.
So this is beginning to sound deja vu from when you first started.
Well, there are many
to start all over again.
There are many battles going on in the city itself to overcome its problems. But there is more hope for the city in communities like that where there are a lot of intelligent, middle class, very liberal people willing to cope with them instead of just flying, going out.
But now, what are the main problems in Park Slope now?
Actually, they're minimal. Now, we have, in a way we never had before, we had one reasonable restaurant in Park Slope when we moved there. If you wanted to go to a restaurant, that was it. Otherwise, there are hamburger places. Now, the streets are lined with restaurants. Fancy, wonderful restaurants.
Expensive.
We had dinner last night in a wonderful restaurant.
That was,
and so you choose among 20 good restaurants on 7th Avenue, 5th Avenue, Smith Street, lined with wonderful restaurants. Expensive. Now, on Saturday night, two Saturdays ago, Evelyn and I were going to eat out. We went to a restaurant. We drove around. We drove from restaurant to restaurant. They were all full. Saturday night at 8 o'clock, we could not get into a restaurant. We eventually ended up picking up a pizza or something like that, taking it home, eating at home. That is what has happened to that community. It's extraordinary.
And you're young.
And young. Now the streets are lined with baby carriages and nannies taking care of the kids. But of course, it reflects the population now. The house next door to us just sold last year for $1.5 million. And it doesn't compare with our house in beauty or whatever it is. So I don't know what ours is worth, but it's worth real money. That sort of thing. That's what's happened in recent years. There are no major problems. Now, I think if the school problem could be solved, we now have one good school, 321. That operates fairly well. The high school is not a good school. So if you have a bright kid who can go into Stuyvesant or get into Stuyvesant, one of those, he's okay. But otherwise, you have to pay for a private school, $15,000 a year or something.
Minimum.
Or minimum, right. So that's a problem. Now, I think that the neighborhood is really deserving of a good school, and I think eventually it will have it. There's a program now to take our local high school, John Jay High School, and do something special with it starting this coming year, I guess. So we'll see what happens.
Are you going to appeal to the Board of Ed to try and get things done?
There's somebody else doing that, you know. Yeah. I have my little business that I handle. But all the other things like getting the streets clean or whatever, that's somebody else's problem.
And the civic council, the hospital.
The civic council handles it.
Okay.
Let me get mine in.
To the city, the first one in the first week.
Okay. Go.
Now, because we have the Brownstone Revival Coalition, thought that we had a good program that worked in New York City, or it was at the right time anyway for doing these things, when there was a shortage of prices were very high in Manhattan and a lot of young people going there and so forth looking for housing, and the Brownstone movement took off because it showed them a possibility. So we thought we had a good program. We just wanted to go national with it. So we decided to have a national conference. We went to the Waldorf Astoria. We sent out something like, we now had funds for this, sent out something like 11,000 invitations to our party, to our conference in New York, which we called Back to the City. back to the city, bringing back people back to the city on the basis of the old housing that most of those cities had. All of the cities in New York were founded by, or most of them had, eventually ended up with rich patrons in the city itself.
Mm-hmm.
So those old houses, often people were left behind. People who owned them moved as the neighborhoods changed, as the kind of city it was changed. The old houses were abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
Because we thought we had a program at the Brownstone Revival Coalition for saving old neighborhoods and using them as a way to preserve the city itself by mm-hmm. keeping people in the city itself, we decided to have a conference that would, at which we could talk about the things we had done and get ideas from other communities where similar things were going on. So we decided to have a conference called Back to the City, bringing people back to the city, to the old, using the old neighborhoods as a core for a revival of the city.
Mm-hmm.
We sent out 11,000 invitations. As a result, we had 250 people from all over the country coming to our conference at the Waldorf Astoria.
From 80 cities?
This is 82 city.
82.
That was in 1972. We had a conference rate from the Waldorf Astoria of $36 a room. That's how long ago that was, more than 30 years ago. We got all those wonderful people. We had an opening. Now, we established a pattern for these things that we used throughout the conferences year after year. Friday night, everybody would come in and we would have a wonderful conference. We would have a wonderful cocktail party. And that was the year we had it at the Century Club. Do you know
Brendan
the Century
Gill.
Club, right? We had a wonderful party for our friend Brendan Gill at the time.
Mm.
And everybody loved it. Then on Saturday, we had an all-day conference discussed with lectures. And we had the president of the National Trust, Mr.
Jimmy Biddle.
Jimmy Biddle.
E-I-D-D-L-E.
Right? He came from Washington. And we actually had a friend who was working for the National Trust at the time. I can't remember his name. Who wrote his speeches, so they all sounded pretty good and said pretty much what we wanted them to say. Now, the National Trust had never discovered cities before. That was made up of little old ladies who were preserving Jefferson's home and this one's home or whatever. But to tackle preservation in the city, the whole community, was a new thing. So we got our friend who had been on, a former board member of the Brownstone Revival Coalition, gone to Washington, worked elsewhere, and he was now working with Jimmy Biddle. So he wrote the speeches announcing the National...
What was his name?
Tom.
Biddle.
Tom, somebody or other. He wrote speeches for Jimmy Biddle announcing that the National Trust would now get involved more in the city things. And they took some of my slides so that Jimmy Biddle could put on a little show showing nice things in the city to worry about, all those things. So that was helped the National Trust to kick off also in new directions. Well, I mean, this has been rich ladies who had nothing to do or worry about the houses of famous citizens or whatever.
As Jim Fitch used to say, they were gray-haired, blue-haired ladies in tennis shoes.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
In New York, it's
right.
Oregon, yeah.
Yeah. So that kicked off a new program for us. We thought it was going to be a one-time conference. The people came there, found it so worthwhile. They wanted to have a conference in their own cities each time. So we had a group of people who were very hot in St. Paul, Minnesota. They were dying to show us. So now, instead of the pattern of this thing evolved at the first conference, we said we had 250 people. We said that everybody, and that we said in advance, not knowing how many people would come, that everybody who came to that conference would have Saturday night dinner in a brownstone house in New York City. So I had my genius over here working it out. We got a lot of people we knew together. They would each say, oh, well, I'll take 10, 12 people, I'll take 14, I'll take 6.
They took 4 and 6.
Well, they took all sorts of numbers. And I don't know how many locations, maybe 15 or 20 around the city, Manhattan and
mm-hmm.
Brooklyn for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And that for every one of these people got a paper telling him how he would get to his destination. If he was going to the village on 11th Street or whatever, he had a paper that would say, from the Waldorf Astoria, you get on this bus, this thing, or whatever. every one of them got one of those papers. When he signed it, he was assigned to a particular place. Now, this is now 30 years later. Some of the friendships made at that time by people who came to New York and had dinner in somebody's house in Brooklyn or Manhattan still exist. People have still friendly because of the warmth of the occasion itself. Didn't go to a restaurant, not in the hotel itself, but in a house that had been revived in a revival community. So that was a very important thing. That established a pattern. Thereafter, we had 13 conferences in 13 different cities, starting in St. Paul, starting, then we went on to Hartford, Connecticut, Washington, D.C., San Antonio, Texas, Milwaukee, all 13 of them. They were all very successful. Now, that also sort of dwindled toward the end. As the idea of preservation of the city got around and people knew about it, and also it was a problem itself. In order to have an organization, those are things you have to have a permanent staff and do it. I'm not very good at raising money. So we had it, it worked there very well, and we did it with the staff of our Brownstone Revival Coalition, doing the letters and doing all that stuff. But after 13 years, also I keep getting older all the time. So that sort of dwindled, but it was an enormous...
That's not true, he gets younger.
It was enormously successful for all those years.
Mm-hmm. Shall we stop a minute and you can do your thing?
Yeah.
This is Evelyn Ortner. Go ahead.
I've gotten into all of this thing that we've been talking about with Everett because I'm an interior designer and a preservationist, and my education has all been in New York City. And I was born 6 blocks away from where we are at this moment, in Yorkville, and which is now a historic district where I was born, right? The Henderson Place. And I married into Brooklyn, and it was the best thing that ever happened. I love it. Anyway, I'm an interior designer and a preservationist, and my education was all through public schools in New York and Hunter College, which was wonderful to me. I graduated cum laude, and that was doing my homework on the subway. And Pratt Institute when I was married, and then I did the graduate program and, of historic preservation technology at Columbia. And but before that, my husband mentioned in the early days of the landmarks, before we had a Landmark Preservation Commission, there were pickets at old Pennsylvania Station, very chic picket line. I was on that. Everybody was on that. Architects, Philip Johnson, Brendan Gill.
At the Metropolitan Museum.
The Metropolitan Museum. We picketed Governor.
The park, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Governor Rockefeller came around. And now, just a nice note over there. This was a picketing line arranged by Bob Mackler, a name that has come up before, who was a park man. I don't know if you know the name. He's a great preservationist of parks. And he had arranged, he's always very good at publicity. So everybody who came on the picket line, the men were all dressed in tuxedos, and the women were all wore...
evening dress.
Evening dresses and fur coats.
Right.
Minks. And we had our dog there, we had a big German Shepherd, so there was this picket line of 20 people all dressed up in front of them.
And Nelson Rockefeller stopped.
TV, right? Nelson Rockefeller came, hire fella. So that was
picketing the Met?
Because we liked picket lines, but mostly because they were, our friend Bob Mackler induced us to get involved in this because he didn't want the Met to start moving into the park, which is what they proposed to do. So that was the, I'm not sure it was the 75th anniversary of the...
Yeah, I don't remember what that was. But...
that was Hoving's time.
Yes, right. Yeah. Exactly right.
Yes, that's right. Well, let's see.
We'll start at the beginning when you bought the...
We There was no commission yet, and I had a campaign. Everybody would send postcards to the mayor, Mayor Wagner, and we got 1,000 postcards saying, please vote yes on for a preservation landmark committee. And it did, it worked. Mm-hmm. So that was 1965-66.
Was that an outgrowth of the Penn Station demolition?
Yeah, right.
It was, yes.
Okay.
And so there we were, and we were living in this area, which we thought was, you know, landmark quality. And we, as Eric said, we went to the commission and we said, we don't have anybody. We don't have anybody to do all the work. And they didn't. They had like 3 people. They had no budget. And Harmy Goldstone was the head of Landmarks Commission. And so we said we would do the work. So Everett and I organized this. And we had a friend who was the editor of Famous Architecture Magazine, John Dixon.
Yeah, it's an architecture magazine that just died a couple of years ago.
John Dixon, D-I-X-O-N.
Right.
Okay. And Morris, I asked him to please give a quick course to 6 people who were going to write architectural descriptions of 1800 houses. Well, of course, it came down to 2 of us who wrote 1800 houses, my friend Bill Younger, William Younger, Younger, and I. And Bill was a teacher, so he was busy during the year, and we would work summers. And we worked through, 7 years.
And going down to the buildings department to look at all the old
research, and then go around and look at the house and do it actual on site. And we did that, and in 1973
it was all prepared in 1970.
Right.
And
well,
because at the time.
Wait, this isn't going to come through if you're back.
But my husband is saying that we finished all the research, and politics being politics and being local in New York particularly, the Landmarks Commission would designate every 3 years.
Right.
So you had 3 years to do your work, and then they would designate.
Right.
And we were ready. And the borough president called me in. Is that Sebastian Leone? Sebastian and Leone is L-E-O-N-E.
Okay.
And he said, you understand, we're going to get your designation for Park Slope, but we have to designate Bedford-Stuyvesant first.
For political reasons.
For political reasons, right?
Right.
So I said, okay. But the thing that happened after that, the law was changed so they could designate any time every year. So we got in and we're finished 1973 designation, which was a blessing.
Yeah.
It was a lot of work, a lot of work. Now, as my husband said, this was the time when Harvey Lichtenstein came to the Brooklyn Academy of Music, and it's not like the Brooklyn Academy today. And he was a great seer and sage, and he knew what to do. And he developed this thing, and we had him in our house speaking to groups, and we took him to the Civic Council. It was a whole different ball of wax then. And consequently, I had these flea market fairs, and we raised money, and then...
Give more detail about the flea market fair. Yeah. Talk about it. Now,
There was a large parking lot, and I sold space for something like $25. And these were people. Some people had stores, some were craftsmen and stuff. And then people paid $1 to come in. And the people who had the stands also paid something back
to me. So I would sometimes I would get $4,000 for a weekend.
But you raised more than $50,000 each summer.
Yeah, for Brooklyn Academy of Music, which was that was a lot of money then.
I have to tell you, when you interrupt each other and you both talk, it won't be transcribed.
Okay.
So really,
you're going to have to do better. Okay.
You have shut up. That's all.
Come on, you don't need this on tape.
So that was my introduction to a big board, and then they got a lot of important people on the board, and the success of the institution, we believe, is the success of the community, the brownstone community, that is the downtown brownstone community. We're calling Brooklyn Heights, Fort Greene, Clinton Hill, Park Slope, Cobble Hill. All of those people were people that would support the Brooklyn Academy of Music and the programs that they had, the dance programs and so forth. So that was one part of our life there. Then the other thing was the Brooklyn Museum. I've always been interested in art. I did watercolors and did other things and when I was at Pratt. And so I became interested in the museum, and I had a meteoric rise. They had something called the Community Committee, which over the years has raised, these are volunteers, over the years has raised millions of dollars for the support of the Brooklyn Academy of Music. It's been about 30, maybe 35 years old, and sometimes we would have an annual ball, and sometimes we have $1 million gross, you know, so that was something very important. And today I have continuing, I have to get this in because it's very important to me. I am a docent at the Brooklyn Museum. And I give tours on everything, but my favorite is Egypt. And I'm learning the hieroglyphs now, which is very difficult and wonderful. I love it. Anyway, we feel very blessed that we are right near BAM, near the Brooklyn Museum of Art, near the important library and near the garden, and we participate in all of those institutions in one way or the other. Now I'm a member, although I've been very delinquent, on the Historical and Cultural Committee of the Municipal Arts Society, Preservation Committee, and I was a member of the board of the Fine Arts Federation, and a founder of the Brooklyn Center Urban Environment, which I was on for many years.
Oh, that's Prospect Park.
Prospect Park, yeah. I forgot about Prospect Park. One of our greatest institutions is Prospect Park, and we love it, and we use it, and we work for it.
And you also participated in saving the old boathouse.
Oh, I forgot about that. The boathouse in Prospect Park dates to the early part of the 20th century, 1907 or 10. And it had been restored, and it had some kind of terracotta facing, which had deteriorated and spalled off the wall from that restoration. And so I went to the Parks Commissioner, who at that time was August Hechter. And August Hechter worked on a program, and we got a new architect. At that time was Giorgio Cavalieri. And
but you and Bob Ackles set out 1,500 postcards,
was it? No, we got Hechter to do it, and he went to the city to get money for the park.
And what year was it?
30 years ago.
Yeah, it must be 72.
So when do you think the first renovation was done? 30?
Probably before.
All restorations.
The second one that we had done was okay, but it fell apart. They just redid it again, and now it's an Audubon Cultural Center. Anyway. Then I went to Columbia, and when I finished, I worked for the New York Chamber of Commerce, and I was in charge of the portraits and the restoration and care of those portraits.
And the
archives. And as I said, David Rockefeller was my boss, and one of my favorite anecdotes was we had some wonderful large urns that were given to Governor DeWitt Clinton upon the completion of the Erie Canal.
From the merchants of New York.
From the New York Chamber of Commerce merchants. And I got a fantastic price, and I went to David Rockefeller and I said, the Metropolitan Museum wants to give us half now and half in 6 months. I thought that was wonderful. He said, no, no way, that downgrades the price. So they got a donor and they paid for it immediately.
This was when the chamber was folding.
Yeah,
selling
right.
Selling a beautiful building to nothing.
Anyway, when I finished at Columbia, I was looking around for something to do. I'm not sure what I was working on at that time. And I got the job here at the Chamber of Commerce. And one day we were passing on Brooklyn Heights, we were passing the Church of St. Anne and the Holy Trinity, and somebody comes out and grabs me and goes, I want you to see this. We need your help. So from that moment on, the next 20 years were involved with the St. Anne Center for Restoration of the Arts. So I called again on Brendan Gill and Susan Henshaw Jones, and we had a whole brownstone church.
Now president of the Museum of the City of New York.
But here in Florence, we had a whole brownstone church. And the brownstone was in terrible condition. But they had a very important, historically important set of stained glass windows. They were the first set of stained glass windows made solely in the United States, 1847, by William Bolton. So that was a very interesting project. I got Kent Barwick came over to look, Brendan Gill came, Susan Henshaw Jones, and we came under the aegis of the New York Landmarks Preservation. What is Peg Breen?
Conservancy.
Conservancy. And that's what I'm doing, restoring those windows all that time. Mm-hmm. But in order to do that, in order to get money for a church, we had to have another function, and which is why we had the function of the art center, performing arts.
Oh.
It was going to be prayer, mm-hmm. preservation in the windows, and performance. So that was that. And now I'm busy studying Egypt, and what I don't know, we've been on, I was on August Heckscher's Prospect Park Advisory Board. I don't remember any of these things, goodness. We've gotten a lot of awards, and I was the research director and designer for ports and terminals of the Fulton Ferry Firehouse, co-founder in 1966 of the Victorian Society in America.
You know Margot Gale?
Margot
Gale used to live in the village. Describe how that was now, the Victorian Society.
Margot Gale.
You said from 1956?
66. Margot Gale met Nicholas Pevsner, Henry Russell Hitchcock, and so forth. And Nicholas Pevsner is great.
You know the name?
He's one of my favorites.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you a funny story later. And Nicholas Pevsner said, in England, in Europe, we have all these other centuries, but you only have the Victorian century there. Why don't you start a Victorian society? And so Margot said, okay. And so she called together some people, and I being one of them, and she said to Stuart Johnson, you'll be president, you'll be this, and you'll be that. And I was the chairman of
programs
or whatever. Well, I didn't know anything about this, you know, but I learned. And we got wonderful publicity on the trips that we have to the Octagon House, things like that.
Just to, you'll probably remember this, on the first big trip they had, they went to Rhode Island to, well, it's a big city in Rhode Island.
Newport.
Newport, right.
Oh,
yeah. They had a tour to Newport. Newport that Evelyn had arranged. It was a weekend or something. We went up there and came back 2 days later or something. Brendan Gill, who was on that tour. Now, what impressed them, they stopped off during the day to have a little respite or something or other, and they served champagne with that one they provided, but she'd also gotten real glasses, not plastic. Now, Brendan Gill was so impressed by that that he wrote a wonderful piece for the New Yorker.
Yeah, on the
off,
town,
which
right.
Which kicked off that whole stuff.
So
that was very, I was involved with that, and went to Addingham with that, and so, stuff like that. So we've been, whatever activity we have, it's been, you know, they've been reciprocals. Everett does one thing, I do another, and they compliment each other.
She doesn't talk very much about what she's done. And she's still involved now. Now, they're on the preservation, the stained glass.
Yes, that's another thing. Well, after we left the St. Anne's and the Holy Trinity, the stained glass studio, which was my interest, and I was responsible for getting Joan Davidson to give, and Tony Wood, who was on my board one time, to give $40,000. If you can believe $40,000 would do that, to start a stained glass studio, which we built. You know, there are special tables and lights and... It was wonderful.
Wow.
And as a result of that, we got... No, it's in Brooklyn Heights.
Mm.
Brooklyn Heights.
Well, now in Dumbo.
Mm. Anyway, when we left the church, which was about 3 years ago, I was interested in maintaining that stained glass studio because we have some of the finest people working on this. And so we now have another organization called the Brooklyn... Stained Glass Conservation Studio. Then we do new windows and old windows, and it's a the Press Foundation has been very, very good to us. They have supported apprentices. Probably we're on our fifth or sixth apprentice that they support, which is very important to us. So it's. It's a teaching
mm-hmm.
and a restoration and a preservation. Yep.
That preserves the technology that would die
yeah.
otherwise.
Okay, I know that we've done a lot of other things I keep forgetting, but that's mainly it. Triangle Parks, I told you about. That was during the Lindsay days. We got him to do Triangle Parks.
You mentioned it, but...
Well... Along Flatbush Avenue and in many other areas of the city there are little areas that are that used to be blacktopped and they had blinking lights, traffic
that's
lights.
I think because the grid of the city is not the same as the old avenue, so they have strange angles.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was talking to somebody who was at the... zoning commission. That was Rick Roseanne. And I said, what can we do? Can we do something about this ugly black top? And maybe
there's
we...
a specific one that you were...
Yes, right. And so he said, we'll get a meeting together with Lindsay. He was a pal of Lindsay's. And we did. Pardon?
His last name again?
His name was Rick Roseanne, Richard Roseanne,
R-O-S-A-N,
one N. And he
said they have the
Urban Land Trust.
Urban Land is, that there's no that in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
So he did indeed, and not only did they put a park with little cobblestones and trees and benches in this one, it became a program for the city to do these triangle parks.
We have one on
They became
well,
part.
They
yep.
put in one, and then they put in the others going along
yeah,
Flatbush Avenue.
Yeah, Flatbush Avenue. That's
right.
Mm-hmm.
So that is very satisfying to see that, you know. And so, I don't know, let's see. Lots of other things, but we've gotten a lot of awards for Spirit of Life and stuff like that.
Yeah, we have a lot of awards.
We don't have enough walls. You know.
But what I get is that our house has become a center of many of these things. They have friends all over. And so now we're quite old, but nonetheless the house goes on. And Emily keeps looking for things. Now, I have to tell you that we had the first meetings of the Brooklyn Secession Society there at our house.
Oh,
yeah, yes, we had several meetings there of that, and unfortunately it didn't come to anything. And we also founded a monarchic society, so that we would give everybody a title. It would be very nice.
Everyone.
Yeah, well, you know, if you join our society, you can become a duchess. So that didn't come to the watch, but it was an occasion for some parties.
Okay. But getting down to back to Park Slope, we are really delighted to be there. It is a vital, young community. And when I go down to the subway and I see all of these young people with their briefcases and stuff and backpacks, I say, you wouldn't be here if it were not for us.
Maybe.
Well, it sounds
and it's really it's changed. It's wonderful
now,
community.
One of the things we think also, the book and the cat, the name Harvey Lichtenstein, mm-hmm. who's the guy who revived the Brooklyn Academy of Music for nothing. It would not have survived if the neighborhoods had not changed for that.
Yeah.
I think that's true. Now, at the same time we were doing these things, we didn't remake New York alone. But there are people like Ruth Goldstein in Fort Greene.
Mm-hmm.
There's, what's his name, Snyder in Cobble Hill. Mm-hmm. Brooklyn Heights had a couple of Pearsall. All those people were all working at the same time, but I think that...
But I think they were energized by the publicity that you got.
We had a program, not just, you know, let's do things better, but we had a program.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a number of people who worked at that program, do this, every so often you do that, you do this. And so I think that that helped make a difference also.
But we hate to keep doing the same thing over and over again. Which is,
well, now we have to shed our responsibilities and try to process it again.
And what about all your papers and things like that?
Nobody would want my papers because they're in my corner of our study where I am now. There's just boxes and boxes of things. So I need somebody. We also have a lot of books. We collect books. I have a big collection of big books.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many it is, maybe 600 or 700 books. So we're threatening to hire a librarian to index them. And all
you can hire a librarian and an archivist. Maybe he can help you go through the papers and file and organize
them. No, we need a librarian.
Well,
I don't want anybody looking at my papers.
We have boxes of papers that concern the founding and preservation of all kids under the organization. Now we get, right now we really need somebody because I get letters in and I can't have them all and all that things. So.
Do you have a VCR here?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, and we can send one of those tapes.
Yeah, I'll send one of them. You know, we had a tape made last year. Not very good. We're going to do better one this year. But,
a tape of?
Of the preservation volunteers.
The video recording of something. Mostly about Gunnison, Colorado. And we got a little bit about
New York.
One nice thing about the cemetery. I'll tell you the sign.
Mm-hmm.
There is an...
Did you move the recorder?
Did
you move the recorder?
I have it on. You wanted it.
I should put it in the middle.
Well, you can turn that around too. We had a number of French people working in Greenwood Cemetery last year, 2002. And there is in Greenwood Cemetery a plaque that belongs to the Société Culinaire of France.
Mm-hmm.
Now these have burial societies in New York. And those poor people always had burial societies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You would come to New York and your family, a death in the family was not only a personal tragedy, it was a financial tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
Where would you get the money for a reasonable funeral and all those things? So somebody from the same town or wherever it was, or Paris or Berlin or from the little Polish shtetls,
mm-hmm.
would establish a burial society. They'd buy a piece of land, and then if something happened to some member of the family, it could be buried there. They would, the society would defray the cost. The French had the same thing. So they had the society cool in the air, blah, 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 philanthropy. Society of Culinary Anthropology, that was the name. And it's founded in 1885, I think. And as of last year, I think they had something like, I don't know, 50, 60, 70 occupants in there. These are all relatives of mostly chefs and people who worked in the restaurants of New York City. So, as a joke, you know, down in Greenwood Cemetery, they thought, hey, wouldn't it be nice if we had these French kids restoring, you know, these old cemetery plots. Mm-hmm. You know how many people are buried in Greenwood Cemetery? More than 600,000 people.
Oh, no, I know.
So you can imagine the work.
600,000?
More than 600,000.
Yeah,
a lot of very, very famous. So they thought it would be fun to have them working on the on this stone, which is their Society Culinaire Philanthropy. Now, the only picture, the cemetery was founded in 1835, so it's almost 200 years old. Mm-hmm. Never has a picture of a live person appeared in their annual report until this last year. Because we put five of those French kids behind this stone that says Society, and there they're all smiling, nice young people. I took their picture, and I gave it to them, and that picture, the first live people to appear in that cemetery, and it'll report. That's publicity.
Boost morale. Thank you very much.
I'll send you a package if you'll give me a card.
Okay.
Thank you all. It's so nice talking to you. Or
thank you so much. We've
won you one friend. Florence out. Yeah.
No, I'm just hoping that it'll
end. You mean, I know you'll see that.
it'll come through, which is what my concern is.